Episode number 8 of The Refinery, where we get together and talk about how to message ourselves into success as a conservative movement. And this is mostly just a meeting of like-minded individuals. It's not a slickly broadcast show. In other words, we don't have comedy routines or opening monologues, and we don't have skits, and we don't have puppets. Yet.
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 Fishy is a puppeteer, so I'm expecting puppets at some point. Anyway, today with me here, we've got T, who lives in Connecticut, JD, who lives in New Jersey, Felicia, who lives in Katy, Delbert, who lives in Oregon, and Corey, who lives in Colorado. So we are all across America. Merca. And Corey, since you've been gone the last 2 weeks in a row, but you've been doing important stuff, so it's been like an excused absence. It's not like you're in trouble or anything, but it is time for you now to read the book report that you wrote on your travels, and now tell us what you've been doing.
Oh my goodness, it's just been really busy. Actually, last week we weren't even in an area where we had cell service, which was interesting.
So you weren't in Merca.
Technically, I think we still were, but yeah, it was just a really great vacation. We went up to Wisconsin and Michigan and visited friends and family, so it was really good. And Andy got to see 3 days of Packer training camp, so he's set for the year now, so he's good.
That's a sports thing, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fishy, I could tell we were still in America because we didn't swim across Lake Superior because it was too cold. But anyway, so before that, though, we had an opportunity to be vendors at the Western Conservative Summit, which is kind of the CPAC of the West here in the Denver area. It's an annual conference put on by the Centennial Institute, which is affiliated with the Colorado Christian University. And it was really fun. We had some really cool things happen. We got to meet a lot of college students, which was exciting to see, and met some famous people like Phelim Macalir, who is the producer of Frack Nation. And I'm an oil and gas person, so I'm big into that movie. But what was really exciting about that was that he tweeted our pro-fracking ad. And I didn't know he was going to do it. It just popped up on my phone. And
Oh,
so
very cool.
may have squealed like a 5-year-old and jumped up
Sure.
and clapped my hands, but there's no video proof of that, so we'll have a hard time proving that. But yeah, it was just a really good conference. We
What
met.
else has that guy done? I know I've heard his name in relation to lots of stuff.
Yeah, he's done quite a few things, and honestly, I don't know his whole background. He's doing a new film on Kermit Gosnell next, and
Okay, that's how I know. He was doing like a Kickstarter thing, wasn't he? Or he
yes,
tried to do Kickstarter, but Kickstarter rejected him, and so he went to, yeah.
a different one and raised just tons and tons of money. So
Yeah.
pretty excited about that. And then we got to see Bo Snerdly, and we got to hear Ben Carson speak, and he brought down the house. Andy and I were texting back and forth because we weren't able to sit together, and just the unity that he was preaching was amazing, and just how we need to pull together, and you don't have to sell out your principles in order to do that. We heard Sarah Palin speak. I mean, just a huge conglomerate of really good quality speakers and leaders.
So tell me, the college students that were there, were they the Christian college students? So it was kind of a self-selected, obviously it's going to be a self-selected group of conservatives, but were they, particularly politically active, like-minded, nothing really to, I mean, were they what you would expect from conservative college students?
Yes and no. I think that we had a wide variety of people there. I don't think that all of them were college students at the college. I think that they did a really good job of reaching out into that community within conservatism and drawing them in. They were able to provide tickets for, I think, $30 a person if you were under the age of 25, if I remember correctly, because they had a lot of other people come forward and sponsor them. So that was pretty cool. I was really encouraged to see that we had such a wide variety of types of people at the summit this year. Because in past years, it's been kind of your typical gray hair, Caucasian, Republican group. And this, the last 2 years, but this year in particular, I saw people from all different backgrounds, all different ages, all different ethnicities, and they were all just having a great time. So, oh, and I have to tell you this one story. It was really cool. We met a young lady named Ivy, and she was actually born in Beirut, but her family are Christians, and they moved to America. And she is a leader in her college Republican group down in Colorado Springs. Well, she came out into the hallway during one of the sessions, and Alan West was out there, and he was just getting mobbed by people. And he was enjoying it and snapping pictures and signing autographs, and that's just kind of his personality. I've seen him do this a few times. But she was so cute because she asked him if they could take a selfie because her camera on her phone was broken. And he said, sure, I would love to do that. So she got a selfie with Alan West, and of course she posted it on her Facebook page right away, and she was so excited. Well, then a little while later, she came back over by our table because she had met Chandra, who was helping us at the summit, and she had to show Chandra the present that she had just gotten. Alan West came out after doing his speech and called her over to the table where he was signing books and handed her his handwritten speech notes.
Whoa.
Yeah. And said that he wanted her to have them. So she was on cloud nine. It was really, really cool.
That is cool. It sounds to me like it's, maybe it's because it's not as well known as CPAC. You know, it didn't get any kind of press or notice really in the conservative blogosphere. I mean, heck, nobody really, I mean, you know, when CPAC is going on, it's all you read about on all the conservative blogs.
Mm-hmm.
And the Western Conservative Summit does not get that kind of attention from the conservative blogosphere. So maybe that makes it a little bit more relaxed, human, personable.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's really gaining a great reputation, and it's growing. In past years, you know, they haven't even filled the ballroom, which seats 2,000 people for the evening sessions. But this year, they actually had it in one of the great big auditoriums at the convention center, and I think they had over 3,000 people the night that Carson spoke, and Jindal spoke that night as well. So it's definitely growing. It's growing a lot, and it was trending quite high on Twitter the entire weekend, too. So, oh, and I have to tell this. I already told Fishy, but I had to make Fishy proud, so I tweeted my heart out, and 5 of my tweets got featured up on the big screen. So it was pretty cool.
Ooh, very cool.
So,
you guys had a booth for the Party of Choice there, right?
Yes, we did, and that was interesting. We still had a lot of people who thought we were all about abortion, of course, and so those are my favorite people to talk to, though, because if you can get them to make eye contact and smile at them and invite them to come over and just ask them if they've heard of the Party of Choice, you can tell their defenses are a mile high. But then once you just start explaining what it's all about, it's like they relax their stance. They start to smile a little bit, and then they start to engage. And by the time they're walking away, they're taking one of everything on the table and going and telling their friends about it. So that's the fun part. And I was kind of surprised there were a lot of people who had heard of us, and so that was pretty fun.
Nice. Of course, their defenses would be a mile high already because it was being held in Denver. Sorry. But it's amazing. It's great to hear that people, you know, knew of the Party of Choice going to the booth. That's a huge thing. And you know, being able to get your tweets up on the big screen. Was this different from most of the other conventions that you guys have gone to?
You know, every year is just a little bit different. I think there was more of a Tea Party presence, more grassroots presence at this one. And it's kind of hard to explain how it feels a little bit different, not in a good or bad way. It's just you have different types of conversations with people, I guess. The one thing that they did that I'm not sure if it was very effective was they split the exhibit hall. And so half of us were at the hotel and half of us were over at the convention center, which I think might have been a little bit difficult because they were so spread apart. So I didn't personally care for that. But,
yeah, that's weird.
Mm-hmm. Because I think we got a lot of the daytime traffic and then the convention center got all the evening traffic. And I knew that there were people there who I wanted to see, but I never found them because it was so spread out, and it was just kind of an odd setup.
Ah, I hate it when that happens.
So that was a little difficult, but we had a really high traffic area, so we got a lot of visibility. And I guess that's about it.
Well, what was the mood? I mean, this was a little bit more than halfway through the primary season.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Republican conservative side of the House should be beginning to ramp up for general election, midterms, beginning to have some conversations about how we drive more voter turnout, how we expand the tent to get more people into the movement. I mean, was there much discussion of that, or was it more on policies and procedures? I mean, what kinds of things was the conference focused on?
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, I didn't get to listen to a lot of the sessions because I was out at the table so much, which is a 22, because I got to talk to a lot of people, but I didn't hear a ton of the content. The night that I heard, Bobby Jindal did a really good job of explaining the types of reforms that they have implemented in Louisiana and how successful they have been. So I think that really got people hyped up and excited and gave them hope that we really can cause some positive change to happen. When Ben Carson spoke, as I mentioned, he was all about unity. He never said anything negative about President Obama, but what he did instead was he talked about the different issues facing our country and then provided workable answers and policy. And it was fascinating to listen to. I mean, he just stood up there and rattled off what he would do or what needs to be done on probably a dozen different issues. So that was pretty neat.
Was there much in terms of unifying theme to messaging, you know, because we're all about messaging and trying to find, you know, some common phrasing that all of the different policies and proposals can fall under. Was there much of that we could sort of start to glom onto?
Not that I heard. One of the things that they did that was a little different this year was they had a lot of breakout sessions. So that was really, really good because you could choose whatever issue it was that you were interested in hearing. But there were so many issues and only a small number of slots to go and hear them. So, like, I went to the one that Caleb Bonham taught, and he was talking about his whole thing is video activism. And he gave a lot of really good information, actually, on how important it is to present yourself well, because you're walking a fine line between exposing something, some liberal policy that's ridiculous, and making yourself look like a jerk. So he gave some really good info on that, which actually I think we could apply here with the refinery. I'll have to pull out my notes and look those over.
Yes, trying not to be jerks is high on our list of things to do.
I think we're okay on that, JD, but I'm just saying.
Especially since Andy isn't here tonight.
Oh. You are going to that, you know.
the Jets play against the Packers. I'm just starting early this year, so.
Oh, is that so? I see. Well, at least he can handle mosquitoes.
Wow.
And that concludes our segment of Trash Talk.
Yes, I know when I've been beat.
Oh, goodness.
So, I mean, you guys got a lot of traffic, you said, at the Party of Choice booth over there. What were the kind of people that were coming to the booth?
They were really concerned, you know, about how we could win. I think that's just a big theme out here in Colorado in general. I think there are a lot of people who want to unite, but don't know how. And so when Andy was talking to them, he had a really effective approach, because he talked about the different issues that Republicans and conservatives and grassroots activists are facing, and that we feel hopelessly divided. We don't feel like we can persuade people around us. And once he started talking about those things, they would start nodding and agreeing. And then he would offer some solutions to that and say, okay, well, this is what we can do to unite, to draw others to our side without compromising our principles, and that's what we do as the Party of Choice. We have trainings, we have presentations, and we had a lot of people ask us if they would come on their radio show or if they would come and speak to their group, so that was also really, really exciting.
Awesome.
Well, and that's true. I'm seeing more and more articles out there that are, in general, sort of directed at finding a way to, I don't know, message in a more helpful, useful way. And it seems to be that, to me, that I guess the time has come for Republicans and conservatives to figure out that stomping our feet and saying Democrats are bad is really not the most winning strategy. It is, in fact, true, but that's not enough to get people to vote our way. I mean, we see a lot of surveys and polls out there that we proclaim and tout about how Democrat policies and procedures are not popular, and that politicians aren't trusted, and that Obama is underwater on every single measure, whatever. And so, yay, that's good. That does mean that the public is primed to listen to us, I guess. But if you look at the second part of most of those polls, they hate Republicans too. And in some cases, they hate Republicans even more.
Right.
So they may hate the Democrats, and they may hate all of these current liberal policies, and they may hate progressivism, but that doesn't mean that they're going to vote for us.
No, it doesn't. And I think that a lot of conservatives realize that, and so they're like, well, okay, but what do we do? And so that's where we were able to say, we can train you on what to do, on what to say, and on how to reach those people who you just don't know what to say.
And I think a lot of times it is a matter of getting beyond yourself and looking, thinking more about what the other person needs to hear, mm-hmm. and less about what you want to say.
Right. And I think it's important, like, you know, we talk about all the time on here, is listening to them, asking them questions. What do they feel? Why do they feel that way? Because most of them, they feel like we just want to dump our answers onto them and give them our solutions. They don't feel valued, and like, we really want to hear what they think.
And we absolutely have to change that. I read a story today that Elijah Cummings and Jason Chaffetz, they're both on the they're both in the House, and they are top in one of the housing committees, it's an oversight committee, one of the oversight committees, and they end up, and it wasn't Elijah, was it Elijah Cummings or Hank Johnson? I think it was Elijah Cummings, because Hank Johnson is the Guam tip-over guy. It was Elijah Cummings who is the, and isn't he the one who thinks it's so funny that that we would even think that legislators would read the bill? Was that Elijah?
That was John Conyers.
Okay. You're right. John Conyers. How do I know Elijah Cummings? What's he famous for?
The recent hearings that they had, I think it was ICE's committee. I think he sits on that committee as well.
Oh, he was the one who was just slobbering all over this IRS guy for deigning to come visit him, and you're so nice to come talk to me. That's right, Elijah. How disgusting. But anyway, Elijah and Jason Chaffetz, they swapped places. They actually went and spent some time in each other's districts. And it may have been just a PR stunt, but it was the kind of thing. And they came back and they each had stories about, you know, I asked the folks in Cummings' district and learned things about them and their issues and the things that were important to them. And I learned how it is that Elijah Cummings is working to support them and their issues. And Elijah said, I went out and talked to Jason's people in Utah, and they have their own issues that are different than the ones that my constituents have, but I can see how what Jason does is he's working on their issues. But mostly they each gained an understanding of and an appreciation for the other person that they hadn't had before. And I think that is so key. I mean, it's like they were walking a mile in each other's shoes, and they're hoping that it might help them be able to get along a little bit better and work towards common solutions a little bit more. And I think that kind of activity is really helpful.
I agree. I agree definitely. The caveat that we have to watch out for on our side are the people who are going to react to that with, oh, we don't want anybody reaching across the aisle. We want our views completely to prevail. And so that anyone who talks to, works with a member of the opposite party is a traitor of some sort. And that's irritating to me in a lot of ways, is specifically around when you're talking, say, criminal justice reform. We have natural allies on the left in that issue that we could certainly use and make a common cause with. But so many people, and you know, I couldn't quantify how many, but I've heard this time and again that if you know so and so is involved in it or approves of it, there must be something wrong with it.
Right.
That knee-jerk stuff is not going to help us.
Well, and things like the criminal justice reform, the huge opportunity we have there is to bring in members of the Libertarian Party. And as we know, on social media, the Libertarian groups, particularly on Google Plus, which is the social media that I use, Libertarians are huge there. There's a ton of Libertarians in the tech community. And so there are some issues that we have that we want to talk about that are really conservative issues, that Libertarians are our natural allies, and yet you're right, you start mentioning that and there will be one or two pushbacks about, well, you know, they're just anarchists and I'm not going to listen to them, or if Elijah Cummings is for it, then I'm against it, and they won't even consider the possibility that it's an idea. I mean, it's the genetic logical fallacy. You're absolutely dismissing an idea based on the source of the idea. People do that all the time with your story that was published on Fox News or Breitbart or Blaze. They will absolutely disregard it because that's a biased source. Well, we do the exact same thing when we say, if Obama likes it, I can't.
Yes, yes. And when we are talking about ideas and the kind of things that we want solutions for, we want action taken to make these things work and to make our government run better, less, but better, what we're ending up with is people with the same exact reaction that we're condemning on the left, mm-hmm. or people who are just knee-jerking to whatever bad reputation Republicans have, Fox News has, whatever. We're condemning them for that while we're doing it.
Well, and I think we miss a lot of opportunities to influence policy when we do that. Sometimes there are laws that come into play or that are being debated before a state legislature, and I've seen this happen where the Republicans are just, they just all jump ship, and they're like, well, I'm not even going to talk about that because I don't like that issue. And so what happens is you end up with a law that's 10 times worse or more damaging or more controlling because you had no balancing factor on that committee or in those discussions or in that debate. When in reality, if they would have stuck around, maybe they could have influenced it a little bit and made it not quite so extreme to the left. But it's just what you guys were saying. We're so quick to just say, oh, well, I can't be on a committee with somebody like that. But also, I think we villainize Republicans who are willing to do that. Look at Romney with Romney Care. Okay, Massachusetts is an extremely liberal state. They wanted some form of socialized health care. Romney worked with his state legislature, and he pushed that legislation to the right as far as he could. But what did the Republicans and the grassroots activists do during the election? They demonized him for it. And they wouldn't even consider the fact that you have to look at the people he was governing. He's not a king. He can't go in there and just say, nope, we're not going to do it that way because I'm a Republican and I don't agree with it. He had to work within the setting that he was governing.
Right, and Texas is not Massachusetts, it's not Iowa, is not Colorado, and we need to keep those things in mind. If we want to have laboratories of the states, they're necessarily going to be different and approach solutions different ways. But let those states that make decisions different from us, you know, find out the consequences before we roll it out. We'll be trailblazers on something else. But, you know, just rejecting something because it's not what you would do in your state, it's extremely short-sighted.
Right, and listen to the person and find out why they did what they did. Romney had really good answers for why he legislated or why he governed the way that he did and why he worked with the legislature in crafting that piece of legislation and that program. But too many people, I saw it all the time, just blew him off and walked away.
Yeah, it's really a shame, and it's not just Mitt Romney by any stretch of the imagination. I can't tell you how many people commenting on stories that Cory Booker is, joining Rand Paul on criminal justice reform issues here in New Jersey, and they're just flat out saying, oh, he's working with Cory Booker, I can never vote for the guy in a presidential election, I can't ever vote for the guy because, there it is, just that guilt by association that somehow, because he's working on an issue that I think is fairly conservative in nature, with Cory Booker, means that it's to a degree, it seems like we've forgotten how the Senate and the House work when it comes to getting laws passed and passing legislation in general.
Right, I totally agree.
I think it's an understandable fear. We've been betrayed so much by Republican legislators over the years and politicians in general and the media and all that, by people who have said that they were conservative and have said that they were working for us, and then we come to find out that they're actually corrupt and cronyist and really not working towards us, and they've used the words negotiation and pragmatism to mean corporatism and cronyism. And so there's certainly a valid amount of distrust amongst the grassroots Tea Party group. We want purity, but it's because we don't trust anyone. And when they say words like negotiation and pragmatism, those are alarm words. Those are buzzwords to us that, oh great, they're about to betray us again. And I mean, my God, on social media you cannot even mention John Boehner unless you're also saying that you spit on him. There's no way you can even say anything nice about John Boehner without being called a rhino. And, in the upcoming elections here in November, we need to work very, very hard to get McConnell elected. Because we can't, in November, even if it's not going to be a massive wave election, the Senate Majority Leader, or the guy who would be Senate Majority Leader, getting defeated by Alison Grimes, that would be a huge, huge loss to the Republican Party. We really need to make sure that Mitch McConnell wins. Mm-hmm. Because, good, bad, or indifferent, he is the Republican nominee for the Senate in Kentucky. And he's actually very good at what he does. And as the leader of the Senate, his job is not to be a doctrinaire conservative. His job is to get legislation passed that can then be enacted. And in order to get legislation passed, you have to negotiate with and compromise with and persuade Democrats, which means you have to be seen as a guy that Democrats can talk to, which means you have to be a guy that a bunch of grassroots Tea Party people are going to consider a rhino. But what it means for us as activists is that we're going to have to be working really hard over the next few months to drag Mitch McConnell over the line. And I myself have held back from even posting articles in support of Mitch McConnell because, I just don't want to deal with the pushback from my own guys. Mm-hmm. Because I haven't seized upon that proper amount of messaging that will help our folks become less emotional, a little bit more practical, a little bit more thoughtful, help them slow down a little bit, think a little bit. And, it's not that they're stupid, because, my God, they're not. They're just looking at social media very quickly, they're reacting, they're typing a comment, and they're moving on. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, they're creating more damage by doing that. And so sometimes I will hold back from posting an article because I don't want the nasty comments, because the nasty comments are out there and influence other people.
And As well as our videos have been doing recently, and they've been doing really, really well, which is really cool. It was awesome. We had our best week last week. And
our best week in a row.
Yes, it is our best week 3 weeks in a row. And how prominently you feature on those clips, Leslie.
Because I never shut up.
You aren't Rush Limbaugh, and you aren't Mark Levin, and you aren't Sean Hannity, so it's hard to compete sometimes when Mitch McConnell is being taken down by X name, and what are you supposed to do? It's very, very tough to combat that, or to even offer a counter to those opinions, to the repetitive beating into people's heads that Mitch McConnell is a traitor rhino, who we can't deal with, so we need to get him out.
It drives me crazy. I can't listen to talk radio much anymore because of that dynamic. And it's sad because I miss a lot, but I can read these hosts in print a lot easier than I can listen. And yet there are people who need that voice to get through their day. And I understand why. They feel beat down. They feel completely surrounded. And it's someone saying what they want to say. But I keep coming back to the concept that the job of the radio host is the pep rally job. It's to get you excited and keep you motivated and inform you about what's going on. But it's not the only voice you should have access to. The movement needs not only the cheerleaders and the warriors, but also the evangelists and the people who go out and witness and talk about the concepts that we're doing to communities that we don't go to. And when you have one division of your army doing something that is affecting the work of the people in another division, it gets a little testy. It gets a little difficult to work in that environment because you're constantly having to undo damage done by another portion of the movement. That's worrisome to me. I think, and if you were to say it to someone that way, well, I'm having to go out there and undo the damage that Levin is doing every day, it's kind of smarmy and it's just superior to say it that way. You may think it really loud, but instead you're trying to explain that there are different voices that need to be heard, and the goal is a far bigger one than just feeling good about what you believe, just feeling as though you're not alone. If you want your feelings to be stroked and validated, that's one thing, but that's not the job of the movement as the whole of the whole, to make everyone feel good about what they believe. It's to actually implement the things that we believe, and that takes more than just someone on the radio.
Well, and yeah. I think it's really important that we respect the different niches that each of us have, because that's something that I've been noticing lately. Is that if you, unless you are exactly like me, then I'm not going to agree with you and I'm not going to work with you. That's the way Democrats are. That's not how Republicans and conservatives should be. We should realize that the reason we're conservatives is because we are all different. We all do think for ourselves. The people I can reach are totally different than the people that Fishy can reach, or that JD can reach, or that Leslie can reach, etc. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. And we actually have experienced a lot of that type of criticism ever since we released our pro-fracking ad. We have gotten pure out hate mail from conservatives who said that they hate the ad, that they could never work with us, that they can't believe we would put something out like this. And just a little background, the ad is...
Because it's pro-fracking?
No, that's not why they don't like it. They don't like it because it's silly. It's comical, it's flat-out ridiculous at some points, but it's designed to reach the apolitical 20-something millennials. Okay, they are the ones who are watching Comedy Central. They're the ones who are watching Family Guy and South Park. They like that type of humor. we're not trying to reach the conservative Christian right middle-aged family who's sitting at home and watching Little House on the Prairie. Okay, we're trying to reach a totally different demographic that a lot of Republicans can't reach. And so we've just been really working with the people who have brought concerns to us and explained to them, look, there are multiple kinds of ads, multiple kinds of messaging out there, and they all reach different people. Something that interests me isn't going to interest you. So let's work together, let's crisscross our efforts, and let's reach a wider audience. That's what we're trying to do, but we'll see if it's working. I don't know.
Well, and these are concepts that people understand in non-political context because they understand that a company is going to create a different ad to run on Lifetime than the ad that they run on ESPN.
Right.
And so you're going to create different materials to target the college audience who is very concerned about fracking than to target somebody who is, you know, looking at reading papers from the American Enterprise Institute. I mean, it's totally different groups of people, so you have totally different content to reach them. And, you know, are you trying to inform somebody about a policy, or are you trying to broaden the tent and give somebody just a little bit of a smidgen of an idea that Republicans are not the bad guy?
Right, and that Republicans can be fun and they can be current.
Right. And people understand this in context of advertising. You know, Apple advertising is not the same on every different show. Beer advertising, although I can't think of a beer company that advertises on Lifetime Channel, so okay, and I don't know that Massengill advertises during ESPN, so there are some limits to my comparison.
Well, I know what you mean.
Well, I mean, you could just go with that. I mean, some things are better through ESPN. Some things hit more people through ESPN. Some things hit more people through Lifetime. That doesn't mean that either of those channels are invalid because they don't address a certain, you know, segment of the populace. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, means that they are more effective for one thing than they are for the other.
Right.
And that's basically what we're saying here, is that there is absolutely a place for the stuff that we get from radio hosts. There's absolutely a place for the stuff that we get from bloggers. There's absolutely a place for the stuff that we get from politicians. It's just that sometimes there's some overlap that doesn't help us quite as much as it could.
Well, and I'm not sure that people are spending enough time thinking about who your target should be for the purpose that you're trying to achieve. And it's not that they're wrong, it's that maybe they haven't thought about a different way or a different purpose. There are a lot of people on social media because it's fun, it's entertaining, and it's a way to do something while they're waiting in line. It's what their friends do. But we're here to say you can take your activities on social media, that time that you're spending on social media, with just a little bit of intent and a little bit of thought about it, you can do pretty much the exact same things you're doing, but also at the same time make the world a better place. You've come to social media and you like to talk about politics. Excellent. And you're sharing all sorts of political stories, and you're a conservative, and you want the world to be more conservative. Well, that's great. If you think about things just a little bit, then you can phrase your introduction in such a way that it reaches out to people who are not predisposed to already agree with you. And all you have to do is reach one. And it's not one a day, it's not one a week, it's just one. And that's all you have to do. And you won't necessarily know when you've done it. But if you take a few seconds, slow down a little bit, and when you reshare, you know, read a story that is, you know, totally entertaining to you, but if you stop and think, you know what, if I reshare this, it really doesn't make Republicans look like nice people. So I'm not going to reshare it. Or this particular story is kind of interesting, and I have an interesting perspective on it, and I can reshare it, and the people who follow me and pay attention to me because of the stuff that I say about genealogy, they might read it and say, oh, that's interesting, and not even realize that they've been hoodwinked into reading a conservative political article. Ha, 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 ha. You know, you can be subversive about it, too, if you just approach your social media activities as something that's potentially more than just entertainment.
And also stay on an upbeat level. The business we get into of arguing with people all the time just creates contention, doesn't open up any room for sharing ideas. I actually use the I love that you're a liberal technique today, and I believe it worked rather well.
Oh, excellent. Do tell.
It was a meme on social media where the liberal person posted that the Republicans had gone home without doing anything, and the things that they did do were cutting benefits to the poor, food for the needy, and so on. So I went in and I told him I appreciated that liberals were concerned about those who needed assistance. But then I went on to share that the government does a lousy job of assisting people, and at times it actually hurts people because it keeps them from doing what they need to do for themselves. And also tied into the fact that we don't have the resources to be helping these people because we're going further and further into debt due to our irresponsible representatives who are spending out of control.
I love that you have that opportunity, the way you said that, to go into things like the ridiculous spending that doesn't, you know, no one could probably see any kind of benefit except for, say, college professors and people running these particular studies and whatever. I like the way you could say to a person who's liberal and very concerned about the poor and the safety net being intact and say, well, I think we'd agree, too, that if the government wasn't spending so much money on studying duck genitalia, that we might be able to do a lot more for people and help them get on their feet. That the way that you approach that opens up so many possibilities. That's really awesome.
I added that into the conversation that if we were in the black and we had responsible representatives and we had the means to do so, then I would probably be on board with the programs that we have for assisting other people.
And it's not just that. It's also there are regulations that are in place that prevent other people from helping, the homeless or those who are, less well off. It's really, really legitimately hard in a lot of places to be charitable, and it's disgusting. So that's yet another thing that you can put into that cocktail of good stuff.
I read today, I don't know where, I'm going to have to look for it and add the link in the description at the end of the video, but I read today where, and somebody saw this and jump in, where there are more people on public assistance than there are in full-time jobs. Is that possible? And that's full-time employment.
Yeah, I had seen a headline a day or two ago and was too depressed and terrified to read the supporting article. We should probably ask Pradeep. I'm sure that's something that he knows about. He's our in-house wonk, Pradeep Shankar. Love him dearly. He will read articles that I absolutely don't have the caffeine to sit through. and I don't know how he does it. But yeah, when you add up the number of people that are on welfare and disability, because the disability rolls have absolutely exploded over the last 5-6 years. I think that's probably what's adding into it. And the number of people that are counted as full-time employees has gone down, even though they've changed full-time employment to 30 hours. And I think certainly if we were to judge full-time employment the way we used to at 40 hours or more, that would probably be even more of a thing. But if it's not exactly upside down like that, it's pretty dang close. partly because the programs have been expanded so much, and the checks and balances against people being on disability who shouldn't necessarily be on disability, and there hasn't been an awful lot of counter to the disability and being able to say, okay, well, maybe you're not able to lift a 100-pound box and put it into the back of a truck anymore because of your back injury, but here's the deal. Instead of using your back and instead of using your arms, you can use your brain, and we will put you at, you can have a different job. You can't have that job you'd had before, but you can have a different job. And so we don't want to just write you a check for disability. We want to help you have a different job, and if the employment environment in general were better, then people would be motivated on their own to say, okay, I lost that one job and I'll just go get a different one. But now, in so many areas of the country, when you lose your job, there aren't any other jobs to get.
Well, and I think we're still in the period where we're transitioning out of your job that you had for your whole life, or your career path that you had for your whole life. More and more younger people are having different jobs, wildly different jobs over the course of their employment history. And people aren't as defined by their jobs anymore, I think, as they used to be, where disability, when it was created, was because you can't do the thing that you've done and the thing that you're trained for anymore. Here's the way that we're going to provide for you so that you're not falling through the cracks. Whereas instead, a much easier and probably far more cost-effective solution would be, as you suggest, a retraining period, an opportunity to do a different job, explore skills they didn't know they had. The system is not built for that because it's, again, right back to what we've been talking about for weeks now, one size fits all. This is the formula that you apply to the person who has lost the job or lost the ability to do the job. And that's, again, another way that we can talk about the way that these policies, for the same programs that, a lot of us would rather see gone, the transition period we can have where we can say we're willing to retool the way this program works in order to help more people and do it better.
Well, and so many of the programs that we have that are crushing us economically are programs that were invented 100 years ago, for an economy that was structured the way life was 100 years ago. It was, like you said, the father is the one who worked. He had the wife and the children at home. He had one job his whole life, worked the same place from the time that he was 16 all the way through, and he went to work from 8 to 5 every day. And so a disability program, if he couldn't work at that factory, and it was a factory town, and if he couldn't work at that factory, he had to get disability because there wasn't anything else we could teach him to do, because all we really had was blue-collar industrial jobs, because we were a blue-collar industrial nation. And very few people without high-level college degrees could actually have accounting careers or any kind of a white-collar career. Nowadays, things are such in our economy that even without a high school diploma, you can have a white-collar job. You can start in a company as a customer service rep answering phones all day, and if you show up every day and give just a little bit of initiative and learn and grow and try to be helpful to the organization you work for, within 6 months to a year, you're transferred into a different department, and in a few years, you can be mid-level management. It's absolutely possible. We have a very mobile economy now. There are so many different jobs people can have that the disability model and the employer-provided healthcare model, there are so many of the structures of our federal government support system that are based on a world that doesn't exist anymore. Just our mass transit that we keep coming up with billions of dollars in bonds for was built around a world where you lived in the suburbs, you worked in the inner city, and at 8 a.m. you went and you got on the train. Everybody in your neighborhood went to the inner city, so you all went the same place, and then at 5 o'clock Well, nowadays people live one place, work a different, they travel during the day, so they need their cars. I mean, we're in a whole different world, and we're still dealing with programs from the turn of the century. So I think in addition to the one-size-fits-all stuff, these progressive programs are they were progressive when Woodrow Wilson was a child, but they're not progressive at all. I mean, these are retrogressive programs that we're dealing with, and we're trying to modify them for modern society rather than just taking a step back and saying, you know what, let's throw away the manual typewriter and get a computer instead. And in fact, instead of getting a computer, let's get a smartphone. And what
that would be nice.
And what federal government is doing is trying to fix the keys on the manual typewriter or spend $1 billion researching how to get more efficiency out of the ribbon.
Well, and I think that's a great way to explain why it's better to have more private sector involvement, more private charity involvement, you name it, because the private sector individuals can adjust to the needs that they're seeing much more quickly than a huge program and a huge government system that is set in its ways and that doesn't like change.
Earlier when Delbert was talking, I didn't catch the first part of it because I had just joined, but he said something and it kind of about if we were in the black, then I would support those programs, and it made me think of the government's main job is to protect the citizens, to secure the border, to have a standing army, to help the citizens, you know, protect against foreign invaders, things like that. So we need to have everyone doing that, and then once the government does that, like that's something the government's way more effective at than people. We couldn't get together, really form a militia, get all the ammunition we need. It would be extremely difficult, but the federal government can. On the other hand, you have almost everything else the federal government's trying to do right now, and people, individuals, are so much better at those things. So much teaching on a local level rather than Common Core once fits all. They're so much better at serving, going down to the local homeless shelter and serving, giving money, yes, or finding someone that you can help and give a job, finding someone that you can help teach. And it's kind of funny to me that all the things the government should do, it's very effective at. That's why they should do it, because they're more effective than individual people. But all the things that they are trying to do are the things that they're not at all effective at, to take ownership of that, to take responsibility, to do those things.
Is my microphone working now?
Yay!
Yay, yes. Okay. Yeah, if you think about it, this is the way things were done until this was outsourced to the government, and it's been lazy to outsource assisting people to the government because there were private, like we've talked about already, private organizations, churches, all that, that helped people in the community level and held them accountable and understood if they were truly needy or not. Now I see so many people getting help that it hurts them in that they don't progress further in their lives and go find the opportunities that they need to find. And an example I think of is during the Depression, the real one. They keep saying the late depressions are horrible depressions, but if you think about the Great Depression, that was horrible, and people got up, they put everything they had in their truck, and they drove to California or states where the opportunities are. And I've done that in my career as I've needed to find better pay, better situation for myself. I've had to move to different parts of the country to obtain that. And now I watch people who choose not to take advantage of any opportunity because they are getting enough unemployment to satisfy their needs. And then they cry for extended unemployment when that runs out.
Yeah, it's, was it Ben Franklin who said that people should not be too comfortable in welfare. That's really bad paraphrasing.
They should not be made comfortable in their poverty.
There you go. And we've done a lot of that out of misguided compassion. And there's no doubt that our intentions were right and our intentions are good. Nobody wants to see somebody hungry or poor or sad, or and it's a lot easier just to, I'll give you money. And all the federal government can do when you've got thousands of people out there is give them money. It's much more effective for, you know, the church or the charitable organization to say, yes, if you can work here for the next 3 hours and hand out things to people, then we will feed you at the end of the day. We'll put you to work for a couple of hours doing something. And that gives the person a few hours of success and positive, they've contributed something positive to society, and they'll feel better about themselves. And they'll come back the next day and want to help for 4 or 5 hours. That's the kind of thing that local charities can do that a federal government simply cannot because it's too far away.
Well, and there's one other factor that's happened since the beginning of all these programs, and that is the interstate. I think we are a far more mobile society. Instead of packing up all your belongings, you're able to, just in the back of a truck and hope for the best. We've got the ability to travel all over the country and look for work and move around, and people change jobs and regions far more easily. And so we're far less connected to our communities as a whole. That is the basis of where charitable giving and the safety net used to come from. So though I'm not blaming, progress necessarily, technological progress, it is a factor to consider. We don't embed in our communities. We don't live in our houses for the whole of our adult lives. We do move around. The fact that my parents, say, are in the same house that they were in when I was 6, is unusual now. It doesn't happen as often. And so I don't live near them anymore. I would have in another kind of economy and another kind of society, but we don't do that. And that makes it more imperative to embed yourself where you are so that you are able to identify needs, so that you do notice if someone is looking like they're slipping through the cracks.
What's the best way to be complacent? And that's what our government has created, and it gives them power, is the ability to say, I am helping people because someone's extracting money from my paycheck. So you don't have to go down, you don't have to get involved, you don't have to get in the trenches, help people out yourselves. You just complain that they're not being helped enough, and also ask your government to please extract more money from other people to help these people in order to make your conscience feel warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad that that's the case, and it's sad that people think that that's a good excuse for not doing more charity work, for paying attention to the community. I think that works in some cases, and that's the cause in some cases. But we do also have to remember that there is, there are a lot of people who are in some trouble that do benefit from, or would be able to benefit from, a much better system than we currently have. I mean, we have a really, really bad, ineffective trap of welfare right now, and that's something that, we don't pay enough attention to from our side, and we don't say, hey, this is a trap. This is not something that you can, that the average person can escape from. And it, Fishy and we've talked about this a lot, just the fact that it is a better decision financially for a lot of people to stay on welfare than it is to get a job, because as soon as you get money coming in, then you get cut off and you aren't able to get the hand up. Instead, you have to stay for the hand out.
And look at the way we talk about it. We talk about those social programs, the safety net, as though we want to end them tomorrow. And that by ending them tomorrow, all sorts of things will happen. People will magically go out and get jobs, be motivated to do so. The problem is we're not going, first of all, to be able to eliminate these vast numbers of programs and the huge quantities that they spend immediately. And so being able to push as hard as we can to cut them down, to restructure them, to give us that time to work that cultural angle and have people understand that the system is flawed and that it needs to be repaired, then we can move toward cutting them off because they're not needed as much. That is the process that I think we need to go through. But we start and stop so often on end entitlements. They're unsustainable. We can't continue to do it. And people on the other side or people in the middle hear that and they just respond completely out of emotion and say, what about all those people? We've got to come up with, and we have come up with the programs, but we've got to come up with a way to talk about these issues that lets people know we really are on their side. We really do want them to do better. And the first step in doing that is reforming the things that are there, eliminating the waste in the programs, trying to make them smarter, trying to make them more responsive to individuals, trying to more likely personalize them than give them that one-size-fits-all solution. And then from there, transition them out. The system is not built for that now, and it's a vulnerability on the left that we can exploit over and over again if we just stop and think, as Leslie was saying earlier, about how we sound when we talk about it.
Well, and I think you're totally onto something, Fishy, because that, especially entitlements like Social Security, that is something that resonates with people in their 30s and younger. They don't like the fact that they're never going to see a penny of that Social Security. They understand, yeah, I'm supporting Grandma and Grandpa right now, but they're looking around and going, well, what about when it's my turn?
Why can't I have my own money? I'm sorry, I just need to jump in here because as a person who is a millennial and I'm in that rut, I would much prefer handing my grandma and grandpa a check than sending it to Washington and hope that somehow it gets around to them.
Yeah.
So John Pierre, in a post this week, mentioned how we need to personalize things. And I think his point was more how things hurt in a bad way. But I think, like Fishy was saying, we can also talk about how we can personalize things in a good way. Talk about these policies on how, you know, we do want to end welfare, but we know it's not going to be a day, a month, a year, because if it did, these bad things would happen to people, and we understand that. So what we plan on doing is, you know, maybe be a gradual thing. Maybe we start a program that will encourage learning new job skills, and at the same time, to fund that program, we cut back some of, you know, the Medicare, Medicaid welfare, something like that. You know, cut back welfare for able-bodied individuals, take that money and teach those able-bodied individuals a new skill. And if we can personalize it and show them how it would help you, if you got in a car accident and you got paralyzed and you couldn't work, would you rather just have someone hand you a bunch of money and not really be able to do anything with your life? Or would you rather change and feel like you're helping society, feel like you're learning, like you're being challenged every day, and have opportunity for growth? Because if you're on Medicaid, Medicare, welfare, you're going to get a set income for the rest of your life. You can still do great things in a new job, in a new career, in a new field. And if we bring that and personalize and show people how the policies and the ideas will help them, help their friends, help their family, then we can hopefully reach them in a better way than political cliches and buzzwords and little slogans like end the Fed, even though it's a great idea. How's it going to actually affect someone?
At my place of former place of business, we would talk about evolutionary versus revolutionary change, and much of what we were guiding our customers towards was evolutionary change from the old way of doing things to the new way of doing things, and that really does make more sense. It's far more sellable to talk about reform rather than absolute replacement, and to talk about evolving the programs to be more efficient and more effective. It's dangerous, of course, because so often that leads to corruption and cronyism and bloat and making things worse rather than just tear it down and start over. But it's far less scary to talk evolution and reform than it is to talk about revolution and, you know, dumping welfare. We want to reform welfare. I want to make welfare work for people. I want to get the crowd out of the safety net. Right now, the safety net has become like a trap, and I want to release people from that trap and get as many people out of the safety net and back into the productive society as we possibly can. And the great thing is there are a million and one ideas. And the cool thing about the way conservatives and the free market works is we free up people to implement and try all of these different ideas, and the ones that are the best are the ones that we go with and we do more of. And when you let some of what the federal government is doing roll down into 50 different states, that lets us have 50 different experiments of how to get people off of welfare, or how to get people off of disability, how to get people retrained and reemployed. And if we can stop so much being done by the federal government with its one-size-fits-all solution, and at least if it has to be a governmental solution, at least let there be 50 of them that we can try. And then when we find out that Iowa's solution is really awesome, then Texas copies it and tweaks it for the Texas population. I didn't want to say that Texas was going to be the best one to come up with the answer, because I feel like I'm always biased in favor of Texas doing everything right. But had I said California's solution was the most successful, my credibility would have been completely shot and nobody would listen to me ever again. Because, you know, sci-fi has to be at least a little believable. And California having the best solution is just, you know, too out there. But, you know, with an evolution versus revolution type of concept and reform rather than replace as a solution or as a proposal, I think might be better messaging to try to talk to people about. And everybody else is muted, so apparently I'm the only one who's going to get to talk today. See, there's a reason all the video clips are of me. I don't mute my microphone, so I can just start talking away, and I talk over all of y'all before you have a chance to hit and unmute.
You're just on a roll. We all liked what you were saying.
You don't stop something with momentum. So.
I think I just crashed into a wall.
You had me at Texas.
I was going to say Oregon, but that would be pandering. So
that would be wrong.
Right. We don't pander. No pander, pander. Although I do like pandas. They're very cute. Wait. I just took Sudafed. Does everybody realize that that's a precursor to meth? So I'm apparently going to be high really soon.
Okay, I'm looking for that mute Leslie button just in case. The dump button for our show. Just in case we need it.
She's in charge of the dump button.
Okay,
let me. She's in charge of the dump button.
Okay, I'm going to pass. I'm going to pass control over to someone else. I will promote JD to also have the controls. Okay, I did. I just shared the controls.
Oh no, we're in so much trouble.
So this place is now controlled by the old lady and the kid. Y'all mind your manners.
Ay, ay, ay.
Ay, ay, ay. I did have another it tied into one size fits all and our messaging and some of this reform, revolution, evolution, revolution stuff. There was a post earlier today about, well, Matt Walsh. He's the very popular blogger, and he wrote a post today about teaching his kid about safe sex. And the topic doesn't really matter. It was that there was a post on social media, and one person objected to the content of the post. And rather than argue with him, I asked him, how did you come up with that understanding of the articles? Because his response to the article was based on a completely different understanding and a completely different read of the article than what I had had. And so I asked him where he came up with, how he got his assumptions, to try to find out what his, how his perspective, how his different perspective was guiding him to an understanding that was so different than my own. And it, his answer helped me to tie in to an article that Ace had written a couple of years ago, and it was about perspective in article, in stories that you see. And you notice it in a movie and in an article, in all TV shows, the author writes a perspective in there. So when you're reading a story, you are taking the role of someone in that story. There's always an I or a me in every movie or every story or every article. So when you read something, you put yourself into it as one of the two or more people in the article. Well, and in this Matt Walsh article, he was writing from the perspective of a married father who believed in chastity prior to marriage. And the person who read the article was not married, was not a father, and was also not a virgin. And so he had the perspective on sex of, well, I'm not the author. I must be the other person. When Matt Walsh wrote his article, there were only two sides of the coin that he talked about. He didn't mean there were only two types of people. He was only talking about those two types of people, a pro and a con. But the person who read the article was not the Matt Walsh side, so he identified himself as the other side. And that made him take an oppositional view to the article. I didn't put myself in the article as much, so I didn't see it that way, but once I saw that this other person had, it made me realize that so often what we write is very pro or con. And if the person can't identify with you because of tribalism or whatever fact it is that you are, if they don't identify with you, then they're going to identify with the other person. And we see it a lot when a white guy is talking about a black criminal. A black person calls into the radio show and they identify with the criminal. Michael Berry hears it all the time. And he's like, well, why are you identifying with the criminal? Are you a criminal? No. But they identified with the criminal because the blackness was more important to them than the non-criminal part. So given when Michael Berry is talking about a black criminal, the person who's listening can either identify with Michael Berry, the white radio talk show host, or the black criminal. And they're choosing to identify with the black criminal, and they're saying that Michael Berry is a racist because he's talking bad about a black person. Well, as much as Michael Berry can say, I'm not talking bad about a black person, I'm talking bad about a criminal. The other person who's listening to the story has to choose which of those two people they identify with, and they're choosing to identify with the blackness rather than with the non-criminal part. And I think in many ways this ties into the I love the reason that you're liberal identification thing. You have to be aware that when you're writing an article or having a conversation that's one side, two side, the person you're talking to is going to choose a side that they agree with. Don't give them too many opportunities to agree with the other side. Give them more opportunities to agree with and identify with you. Become a part of their tribe, and then you can persuade. And if you don't really understand that that's happening in your viewers and in your readers and in your listeners, you're going to lose them a lot if you don't really recognize that they are choosing one of the two to identify with, and they're not going to choose what you think.
That's something to think about. I mean, it's an interesting perspective on the article, you know, on knowing your audience. And I think that's a big deal. Obviously, when you're writing, knowing who it is that you're writing for and writing about and all of that, I say as
Kurt falls off the wall again.
Kurt falls off the wall again. But knowing who your audience is and how you're presenting your case, it's a big deal. It's a big part of writing. I don't know how exactly, if you are going to write about, I mean, and you are saying that this is on every subject, pretty much.
Yeah.
If you're writing about football, somebody's going to take the opposite side of what it is that you're saying. this is talking about commentary, not direct reporting.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there would be a limited amount of ability that you have to prevent the other side of the polarization from occurring. You know, I don't know how exactly you're going to be able to. You know, obviously, you don't want to say outlandishly bad things. I mean, we've had this discussion about the bumper sticker. There are, you know, the anti-welfare bumper sticker, like two episodes or three episodes ago. So I can understand from that perspective that you don't want to be abusive towards a particular side, but I don't know how you would present your case in a way that would completely eliminate or minimize the that bias there that you're talking about.
Well, in the case of the Matt Walsh article, and Matt does this, it's part of his shtick, it's part of what he does, and it's his writing style. But he didn't leave, apparently, he didn't leave much room in the article for a person to choose to identify with the third way of being. Matt was just talking about chastity versus hookup culture. And since those were the only two things he was talking about, and maybe he didn't think about this, or maybe he didn't care, I don't know. But somebody reading that, when you're only given two choices of types of people that there are in the world, you have to choose to be one of those, and you're either chaste or you're a part of hookup culture. And even though when I read the article, I realized I am neither, and I'm not going to identify with either one, and I'm just going to read the article, and I'm not going to tie it all up into my own self-identity, but other people do, and it's perfectly valid and natural, and it's rational to understand that people will. And if you're trying, you know, just, I think there are ways you can throw some phrasing in there or ways you can explain your case that, I'm going to teach my child to be chaste. The world is full of hookup culture, and I know that there is a vast medium in between that a lot of people really reside in. But it seems that in teaching your children, we're given two options, and I'm going to choose this option. He didn't clarify it enough, I guess.
Well, okay, I'm not going to pick on Matt Walsh here exactly, but he is not a guy who writes with his audience foremost in mind. He's the guy who writes with the idea of getting his ideas out there.
Right, absolutely. That's a style that isn't going to bring a lot of people under the conservative tent. That article was and great for him, and he's doing his thing. But that article was, and the commentary on it was great as a reminder for me, just as Ace's article from a couple of years ago in reading about perspective, it was great for me because I choose a different route in the things I write. I don't want to engender the kind of reactions that Matt does. So in learning from what Matt did and the way he wrote his article and the reaction he got from it, and by asking how the other guy came up with his perspective and then putting it together with what Ace had written and with what Corey and Andy have been teaching about, you know, siding with the enemy, siding with the opponent, it helped me to see, okay, so now when I write, I need to be just a little bit more aware that if I'm setting up a dichotomy, that I am making sure that my readers are choosing to identify with the person I want them to identify with, because I don't want them to choose to be more the criminal than the law-abiding citizen. I want them to identify with the law-abiding citizen. I want them to identify with the conservative. And I need to either set up a dichotomy properly or provide three choices and let them choose, kind of thing.
Well, the interesting thing is, to me, too, the reaction of people listening to that exchange between Michael Berry and the caller, because most people listening to the exchange in my imagination are going, how is this person so far off, you know, that they would be identifying with the wrong guy in this scenario? And it's a lack of imagination on our part. And the way that you'd explained it, it does drive home the point that we have to, if we are persuaders, if we are going to be persuaders, we have to think about things in terms of that, and not to take that first knee-jerk reaction to, oh my gosh, who is this person that's agreeing with the wrong side? And I think it's fabulous that you went and actually explored the reaction this guy had to the article rather than just getting into a back and forth about it that so many of us would do. That's a really great example of modeling good behavior about resolving conflicts rather than escalating them. There's enough people pouring gasoline on the fires. It's really great that we can have people in positions of leadership, especially in conservative union, who are doing the exact opposite.
Thank you. I just like asking questions. A part of it is just a natural curiosity with what makes you think that. How is it you think that way? And then using that with information that I've read and learned throughout from years. And it was really kind of an aha moment this afternoon to hear his explanation and put it in there with, combine it with Matt, the way Matt wrote his article, what I've heard from Michael Berry on the radio, what I've read from Ace a couple of years ago, and then to tie it in with what Corey and Andy are doing with the I love the reason you're liberal, and as we've talked about multiple times, the best way to convince somebody is not to argue against them, but to stand next to them and lead them in your direction.
Yeah, and what's worse than just arguing against them is the finger wagging that we have a tendency to do.
Okay.
That's where you turn so many people that could be potential allies into absolute enemies. And we have, I think that one of our biggest problems image-wise is that we are seen as the, not only the party of no, but the party of no-no. Of no-no, don't do that, no. And that's our problem.
It's accurate, though. It's an accurate perception.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, it is. There are a lot of people that we have in our in our movement that are like that. That it is not an unfair portrayal of certain of our people.
This is what the reputation that Rick Santorum is out there giving us. When you go back and look at the interview he did with Kennedy on the independence, one of the things that he talked about from his frame of reference was that the pursuit of happiness was that you were free to pursue happiness, meaning your purpose that God had given you. And a lot of people would agree with that definition, that you're supposed to find the direction that God has for your life and go in that direction. But that leaves a significant portion of the population out. And the founders, I think, were wise enough to have, you know, determined that pursue your own happiness means that you make the choices and you make the decisions in your life and pursue your purpose and the thing that you want to do in your way without someone giving you the formula to do it. But Santorum's view is completely religion dependent. And it limits us in talking to people when he says things like that. If that's his definition, he's omitting a huge number of people that aren't there yet. And when we have messengers like that are, you know, confining the way that our founders set up this nation in their definitions, it yeah. does look like finger wagging. It does look like, well, if you don't have a God, then you don't have a purpose, then you can't pursue your happiness because God didn't tell you what to do, so I'll do it for you. That's what it comes across as.
Yeah. There, to an atheist, there's a very big difference between you're free to follow or to learn and do what God wants you to do, and you're free to do whatever you'd like to do. there's a huge difference in the connotation behind what they're saying. And it, like Felicia said, it does limit a lot of who we can reach, who we can talk to, and who wants to listen to the message.
And I think there is a significant number of people in the conservative movement who are interested in remaking the country and the culture after their own image. I understand the temptation, especially when, say, conservative Christians have been so attacked and ridiculed and the culture has just savaged them. I get that. But at the same time, the willful disregard of the multiplicity of types of people that are out there isn't going to do any favors, especially for people who decide that they want to evangelize politically for religious means. It's not a good combo.
Yeah, well, I think we need to be really careful to kind of root those people out and point them out. I mean, progressives took over the Democrat Party, and a lot of Democrats are sitting there going, what happened? Where did all this go? If we're not careful, we're going to get the same thing. Instead of choosing our health care and choosing, you know, what to do with our money, instead, if those type of people get office, it's going to be, you have to go to this church, or you have to follow this, you know, religious rite and things like that. It's the same thing, just the other side, just different things they're controlling. We need to be careful to point that out and to bring it out so that it's not, they don't take over the conservative movement too.
I know Corey has something to say here, but I just want to jump in real quick and say, I don't think that that is the majority opinion among religious conservatives by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think that that's the case at all, that they want to come in and decide for you, you know, what you are doing religiously and what, you know, any of those things. I do not think that's the case. I think there is a vocal and passionate subset that may want to get into that business, but
And they give the rest of us bad names.
Yes, they give a...
I agree.
Same
thing with the progressives on the left. There's a vocal majority.
Not just progressives.
Not mentioning Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his whole nanny state finger-wagging stuff.
Yeah, there's some people like him. Most Democrats don't believe in that, don't go along with it.
Yeah.
But there's the vocal majority that are in control that do.
Right. They have their religious totalitarians.
Yeah, and I want to go off of what JD said, because he's exactly right. There is a subset that feel it's their obligation to push their morality on others because they believe it's beneficial. They see the benefits of living a certain way, and it's protected them from harm, so they want to have others be protected from harm, and so they're pushing it. But something that Andy always talks about in his trainings and his talks, and it's very effective, is that Jesus and the apostles never, ever used the government to push their morality on others. Instead, what they did was they offered and modeled it. And so we've just seen in talking to Christians, when we explain that to them and we point that out, it's like this huge weight falls off of their shoulders. Because there are a lot of people, I'm not talking about the zealots or the people who are very, very passionate and are going to push their morality no matter what. There's a big group in the middle who feel obligated to push their views, but they don't like to because it's uncomfortable and they don't feel that it's right. And so then when you take the time to explain to them, okay, but let's look at this from a truly biblical perspective. Jesus never did it that way. He never told us to do it that way. And instead, when you're talking to people, if you ask them what they believe, why they believe it, and then you say, okay, well, can I tell you what I believe and why? They're much more likely to listen, and then you come across as reasonable because you're explaining why you believe what you believe, and you're giving good reasons for those beliefs. You're not telling the other person they have to live that way, but you're just saying, this is what I believe. These are the benefits I've experienced or that I've seen. This is why. Take it or leave it. They're going to carry that with them a lot longer than somebody who's wagging their finger in their face.
Absolutely. And speaking of wagging fingers in people's faces, Fishy touched on it before. We need to get further into this, and we need to draw this comparison a lot more. is the fact that it's not like the left doesn't do this exact same thing. There's no end to leftist nannyism going, you know, running rampant in the United States culture right now. You know, we can talk about Michael Bloomberg. We can talk about the bans on you know, constructing build. You know, you can't get a permit to build a you know, a mini mall because of turtles that are in the area. There's a ton.
Michelle Obama and your children's lunch.
Sure. I mean, there's a ton of the left is all about enforcing their morality on us.
Right.
And if you know, somehow we just don't draw the same comparison that the left is able to make when it comes to, you know, Rick Santorum and his religious moral push, we don't seem to be able to have the secular morality deal. We don't seem to be able to pin that tail on the donkeys. We aren't able to make that same thing stick. And it's the same premise.
And it's infuriating.
And they're far more successful. They've got so many laws enabled. Where's the law telling me I have to go to a particular church? There isn't any. There's the boogeyman threat of all of this conservative theocracy, but it's not real. The progressive, secular, environmentalism, theocracy crap. I mean, look at what global warming has done. They've enacted their religion.
Oh, they totally force it, and they're glad to force it. They are proud of their efforts, and they just get together and they talk about ways that they can do it more. I've been to some of their meetings, and I've heard them do it. It's amazing.
So why is it that, I mean, I've certainly seen people talk about the church of environmentalism. We've had that, you know, people have used that as a meme, but it doesn't go so far. How is it that we take this, you know, enforcing their morals on the entire country? How is it that we take that enforced morality and, you know, reveal it for what it is and put those words into their mouths and make it, you know, apparent that this is what they're doing? Is it going to take us, you know, putting a comparison up there of Rick Santorum and Michael Bloomberg? Is that something that we should do? Is that something that, yeah, because then there's a problem with that. I'm envisioning right now, because I've been, you know, making some graphics for Free Radical Network recently, and just putting in my head the image of Rick Santorum and Michael Bloomberg juxtaposed with their own quotes on morality, how they see it, whether it's on guns or on 64-ounce Coca-Colas. I don't know that you're going to be able to successfully get the people who don't like Rick Santorum to equally not like Michael Bloomberg. We need to figure out a better strategy of being able to reveal this disgusting infringement on everyone else.
Do you think it would work to put a Bloomberg quote or an Obama quote or a Hillary Clinton quote on Michelle Bachmann picture, Sarah Palin picture? Because people fall for fake Palin and fake Bachmann quotes all the time, and then maybe at the bottom in small type, just kidding, that was really Michelle Obama that said that. Just kidding, that was, you know, it would get them to look at it. They would. I don't know that they'd look into it, and I don't know that they'd care, but it might be a way to get a foot in the door.
I know what you're saying. A Who Said It video, yeah, Fishy is right. A Who Said It video, that she's put in the chat there. That would be an interesting way to do it. But, yeah, I don't think that the misattribution picture thing, I don't think so, because I've seen just too many people get confused on that, and it causes a lot of trouble. So I think we need to do something that's more...
Or a picture of Bloomberg with a church steeple, and and one of his quotes or laws that he's passed, and it's the Church of Bloomberg imply that it's a religious thing? Or, you know, theocracy kind of, I don't know.
It's just, as I said, that already exists. There are people out there that are pushing the Church of Environmentalism idea. It's just that, you know, going back to what we were discussing before about immediately turning off half of the people out there that you're trying to address, it's hard to make that stick and have people really not balkanize against it. And that's just the same if you have a Rick Santorum image. I mean, I can't tell you how many times during the 2012 presidential cycle I dislike Rick Santorum's politics, like everything about it. I there are very, very few areas where he and I agree. But I immediately, after seeing the Democrats or seeing pictures that defame Rick Santorum or saying awful things about him or his family or anything that's really just bad about him, it just made me as a conservative feel, ugh, no, I don't want any of this. This is stupid. Get this away from me. And you're a bad person for making it. So, you know, I don't know that you're going to get that kind of same reaction from everyone, but I think that we need to come up with a better way than just that kind of imaging. I don't know how we do it, but there's definitely something there. There's definitely a comparison that we can draw. There's definitely something that needs to be out there that people need to be aware of, but we're not doing it right just yet.
This is as crazy as that, and I don't like either one because I believe in the free market kind of thing.
Right, but then people are going to accuse you of being a libertarian, and that's not true. Something that's not a fate anyone wants.
And I think Corey would back me up here too. That's one, you know, Rick Santorum may be extremely on the end of it, that spectrum, but that's one of the coalitions that you're going to need. And if you're throwing Rick Santorum under the bus, you're going to have a lot of people that are disaffected and that are not going to trust, you know, whoever ends up the replacement. So, you know, that's a minefield. But I'm sure we can think about how to, you know, recast the left and their moralists, maybe without doing some of our moralists as much damage as we'd like to.
There are plenty of people that are out there that are already going to, you know, rain hell on Rick Santorum. They're absolutely, you know, they have a ton of people on the left that are constantly barraging Rick Santorum with everything. That's not a job that any of us need to do. That's completely, there are no vacancies there. There's no money in that business. It's a cottage industry that the left owns. No, you know, Republicans need not apply. So I'm not doing it.
Well, and maybe instead of focusing on an individual, after all, we are trying to preach unity, talking about the ideas or the concepts or the tactics that are being used to push a concept, maybe that would be the better way to go at it.
Right. It's not Michael Bloomberg we hate, because I don't. It's a few of his crazy over-the-top nanny state policies, and it's certainly not Rick Santorum that I hate, because I don't. It's a few of his theocratic big government policies. Same with Mike Huckabee and any of the big government conservatives. It's just there's some of their policies that I disagree with. But I will tell you that if by some bizarre happenstance Rick Santorum ended up being the nominee, I wouldn't have any worries about voting for him, because he would never succeed in getting that stuff implemented. And it would, you know, it would only happen if, like in you know, the movie King Ralph, if there was a big, you know, a photograph taken of all of the Republican candidates for POTUS, and it blew up, and only one and the only one who survived was the one who wasn't there, and that was Rick Santorum. You know what I mean?
I got to say that we have to keep in mind that the strategy of the left is to savage individually one by one, the Alinsky model, polarize, right. Pick a target, polarize, freeze it, polarize it, they're taking our spokesmen, our leaders, the voices of our movement out one by one, and this is what they do, making our people toxic. I don't have any qualms about making some of the left control freaks toxic at all.
Yeah, we need to be doing that because we need to show how they are all about controlling and they won't allow you to think for yourself or make your own decisions. So, yeah, I have no problem with that either.
But by the same token, I think Bloomberg is a bad target because he's not going to be running for president, I don't believe so.
Yeah, but I think that some of the things he does are just so funny.
That's true.
They're really good at reaching out to people on the other side who are like, wait, I can't get West Side's drink again? Why?
I want a big gulp. Come on, man.
It was trans fats. It was salt.
The salt cracked.
It was drinks. It was even coffee, I think, was under the gun there. And there was even a proposal about earbuds. Okay,
really?
And all that under Bloomberg. Now, what is Bloomberg doing now? Well, we talked about it last week, the Everytown ad.
Mm-hmm.
Guy is still very much engaged. He's, the left is better at hiding their predominant funders and shadowing, behind the scenes figures. But I have no problem dragging those guys out into the light and saying, aha, I smelled this before. It's shades of Bloomberg, whatever. Even though the guy is not in office anymore, there's still damage from that mindset. And if you can poison him, as a source of some of that, it is interesting how, though, those initiatives that he has launched haven't been succeeding too well. He's been spending a lot of money to affect policy and has gotten very little in return.
So it's kind of like a success, and maybe continuing to hammer on Bloomberg is a good thing because it can, the more failure they get, the more they deserve and the more we can build on that. And that kind of leads to a question, and it's one of those things that I think about and it gets tossed around a lot. How do we use Alinsky tactics to our benefit without being dragged down into the mud, without being, yeah, so's your mom kind of arguers? And we know that we will get ripped apart for using Alinsky tactics because we don't have the culture, the education, the media, or the political realm. So, it's like in the early days of Women's Lib, a woman had to be better than all the men she worked with in order to be seen as the equals. We don't get the same leeway that liberals do with our tactics, but we need to use the Alinsky tactics and make them work for us with our morality and our principles still in place. How do we do that without being jerks?
There's actually an owner's manual to that. Rules for Radicals Defeated, and I've read it a couple of years ago, and it was a really interesting read because it diagrams and dissects all of the Alinsky rules, what they're doing, and then the conservative response and the conservative way to utilize the good parts, the effective parts, without losing our core. So I'm recommending that to people. Rules for Radicals Defeated. It's available on Amazon for a couple bucks. It's on Kindle, etc. It's a good read, definitely.
Cool. Looking that up now.
Yes. Everyone go buy that because it is an eye-opener. It's a very detailed examination and dissection of Alinsky and the tactics and the reasons, but also what are we going to do with it? How can we fight effectively when that's what's coming at us?
Cool. I wonder if it's available on the Google Bookstore, because I have actual credits for that, so I could get it for kind of free. And I'm fiscally conservative, a.k.a. cheap, that way.
Yeah, I really do hope that we are able to figure out how to approach this, because, I mean, Reason Magazine does a lot of this. They have a great series every month, Nanny of the Month, and go through these kinds of ridiculous either legislation or stuff that's happening, enforcement of regulation. Actually, it's funny that you mention that, because I know somebody recently who got pulled over because they had a little chain on their rear view mirror. You know, and this is amazing to me. They got a ticket for having a little tchotchke or whatever on their mirror. And I know people who drive around with rosary beads on their mirror and all sorts of other things. And this is the kind of crap that we're pulling people over for?
11 million illegals. Driving without insurance, licenses, or sobriety. And we're concerned about a guy with a tchotchke on his rearview mirror?
Well, let's not... And see, the hard thing about that situation is that you can't really say that all illegals aren't criminals, because by definition
they are.
Yeah.
I'm an illegal non-criminal. Wait, what?
But it is really, I do think it is unfair to portray every single illegal, and we do that too often on our side, that every single illegal is automatically a, you know, drug smuggling bad person. So you know, that's something that we want to avoid. But It is very frustrating that these policies are out there, and that I'm sure that this is not something that Republicans came up with. This doesn't sound like, but if they were, then we need to call them out too.
You know, I'm tough on crime, and that's a distraction, and we need to have a law against driving while texting, and we need to have a law against, and there needs to be a law, and I have to have a law. Yeah.
Let's not go down there, because then people start like getting twitchy and feeling really, really. I wrote an article on this. I know Fishy is also very unhappy, we'll say, about people who think that there ought to be a law. That's not a phrase that we particularly enjoy. But pointing out the nannyism and how it is more, it has had more of an impact on society, on the everyday person, than what Rick Santorum does. Figuring out how to make that parallel, how to figure out how to make people understand that it's not the right that is getting into people's business, getting into people's bedrooms. In California, let's do that. How about that? Let's talk about that comparison. In California, the porn industry has basically died because of condom regulations that you have to wear a condom during porn or whatever. That's you're going to be pretty. How are you going to tell me that was a Republican legislature that decided that one?
Yeah, true.
And that's getting into people's bedrooms. That's, I mean, there's just a lot of stuff here that we are not taking advantage of as well as we should. And it's
I'm really looking for that magical tie it together hashtag that we can throw out our Nanny of the Month stories and our bad law of the week and our stupid government, and, you know, government is inefficient. This is old-fashioned. This is one-size-fits-all. I'm looking for bad government, or government is bad. I'm looking for some kind of hashtag that can be attached to all of these different examples and stories that we see that conveys the message of federal government is too big, and it has to be shrunk down, and Where's my hashtag that can tie all of that together and can be the campaign that everything rolls into that conveys the message that we've got to shrink the federal government and bust it down to the states and have more free market?
I think that's tough to do that because there are so many facets of this argument. And, you know, we've talked about before, we aren't the party of one-size-fits-all, so it's very difficult to come up with a one-size-fits-all hashtag because there are just so many of these problems out there that you couldn't really fit it under one header. There's just, it's not going to work like that. But I'm talking about on a case-by-case basis. It's difficult to use these examples in a way that is effective at hitting the middle and making them understand that, hey, this isn't just the right, it isn't just the way that the left portrays the right. It is actually happening now from the left, getting into your business and putting a cramp on your style.
It just reminds me of the Remy video, up in your grill, if we could figure out a way to play on that, because they go into everything about, you know, these things that you would find at a 4th of July picnic and, you know, too fat, too salty, you know, that sort of thing. That resonates with me, but I don't know how you could put that into a hashtag. We've got enough brains, you know, between the people that watch and us and the show. We'll come up with some, but let's keep that top of mind, too.
Well, yeah. And this would probably be a good time to tell people that you can reach us by tweeting us at the Free Radical at Free Radical Net, at CU Organization, at Party of Choice. Those are all of our Twitter handles, and you can, you know, reach us on Facebook at Free Radical Network and at Conservative Union and Party of Choice on all of those things. Just search us up there. So, I mean, those are. Those are where you can find us, and we are more than willing to listen to what you guys have to say. We want to get that feedback. Leave a comment. Leave a comment on the video, because
YouTube comments. We haven't gotten a whole lot, have we?
We have. We've gotten more this past week than we've ever had. I would like to see a lot more comments, though. I would love to hear more from people who have an idea or have a disagreement or, you know, anything. I would like to hear from our viewers, because we got a lot of views last week on a lot of videos. I guess now would be a good time to mention that, since we're almost at the end of the show. But I really want to thank everybody who's watched and everybody who's shared and everybody who's paid attention to The Refinery, because last week we had 3 videos with over 100 views, and I know in the grand scheme of YouTube that's like nothing, whatever. But for us it was really, really cool to see that we had 3 videos over 100 views. We also have 2 videos that are pretty much now almost to 250 views a piece. That was The View and the Rand Paul, the left fears Rand Paul. Those 2 videos did really well and got shared a bunch. You know, hopefully we'll get some good views this week, and hopefully we can get more people into the chat room. Which, you know, that's a great thing. That's being a part of the conversation and actually able to, you know, talk with us here.
Right, and that is why it's The Refinery, not just for this, you know, 2-hour segment on a Tuesday night, but it's always ongoing. We throw things out, but that's not the solution. That's not the end of the discussion. We're kicking things off, and we're hoping that people will, you know, add their 2 cents or $2, whatever it is, however much you've got to bring to the table. It's an ongoing process every day. The reason we cut these videos up and make them as small, digestible bits is because we can pick one topic and invite conversation on that one topic and hope that people have more input. We're certainly not the sum total of all the intelligence on the conservative side at all, nor do we pretend to be. We're kicking things off. We're opening up the discussion, and then you know, where it goes from there is up to the people who are watching and commenting. So do that. continue to do that. We really do appreciate that, and we take some of those comments back and refine what we do.
Yes, we are not very big on the stagnation game. That's not what we're in it for. That's not what we want to do. We want to get better, and it's not just for the show. We want the whole movement to get better. We want to have an effect. We want to get more wins. We want to get people elected. We want to get people involved in getting people elected, and figure out how to sway people from voting for, you know, Democrats or not voting at all, and get them to our side. And you know, if we have given strategies to people, or if you guys have strategies that you think are effective, we want to hear about them. And you know, I think I speak for all of us with that. We really want to hear from everyone. If you have a good solution, we want to hear about it.
Yeah, I was actually just going to jump in and say that. If you think you have something to say, you want a voice, contact us. We'll have you on. We can do an interview. We'd love to hear your ideas, hear your thoughts on what we're talking about, hear what's important to you, see if we can maybe help bounce ideas off us, see if we can give you some insight to work forward on your project. You know, a few weeks ago, we had John Pierre on, and it was great to talk to him, bounce ideas off him. I've seen a few articles that he's written in the past few weeks kind of referencing the refinery here and what we do and what he learned from us. Yeah, hopefully we'll have Kurt Schlichter on here soon. I know Fishy's working on that. So that'll be awesome.
Okay, I don't know. Can I change the focus to JD? Do we just have JD talk? Let me see if I can change the focus to JD. Hold that up again.
I don't know if you can do that, but I just have to. I can speak. I can speak, and it'll show the image of Conservative Insurgency, which is another book that you should buy and do it like right now, pronto, because it's excellent, and it is a blueprint for getting stuff done in the future of the conservative movement. So do it. Fishy, I know, just finished it. I know a lot of people in my circles have said that they're in the middle of it, or they're working on it, or you know, it is an excellent book that everyone should read. And we are not getting paid for this still.
It's a science. It's a science fiction.
We don't want to.
It's a science fiction book about a future in which conservatives have taken over America, and we can make it into reality. We can make it be science fact if we follow the rules given to us by our Lord and Master Kurt Schlichter.
Oh, shit. No, I encourage people, really. One of the great things about this book, and I'm done. Chapter 4. I'm always landing on one chapter in Kurt's book or another. But this one was chapter 4, Regular People. And it goes into vast detail of the history of all the people who got involved and all the things that they did. And very few names, big names, are in play there. It's individuals. It's the people. Oh, stop, JD. Come on. Nobody can see that. The individuals who go out and find their competency, find what they're good at, go get better at it, and help in that way. It is such an encouragement. So even if you just get the book for chapter 4, you will have done yourself a huge favor.
And with that, with our unpaid advertising break at the end of the show, I think we'll close off this episode. It seems weird to call them episodes when it really is just a meeting that we're broadcasting on the internet. But, you know, let's go with the terminology that has been used. So thank you very much, everybody, for showing up. And we will try to get better about advertising where you can find the chat, because I know that I'm not very good at mentioning that when the show starts, but thank you guys for participating in the chat who did, and we will see you next week, Tuesday at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, and that would be 6:30, okay, wait, that would be 8:30 for me and Fishy time, and that would be 7:30 for Corey and Andy because they're in Colorado, and that's 6:30 for Delbert, who is all the way over on the West Coast. And I have no idea what time that is in Hawaii, but I would like to be there and have the opportunity to tell you what time it is someday. Maybe we can have a hangout in real life in Hawaii, paid for by all the advertising revenue that we get from Kurt as thanks for advertising his book. Yeah, did I mention that I'm on drugs? No. Oh, now everybody's shocked that I said that. Okay, anyway, thank you guys, and we will see you next week.